So welcome everyone to Hinduism 1, the first lecture of the course Hinduism 1 for the theology faculty undergraduate program, track 3. This morning I'm going to go through the course outline and tell you what the course is going to be about, and then do an introductory lecture on really raising the question, what is Hinduism? So in front of you you've got Hinduism 1 Themes and Textual Sources, which is the title of this current course. And it's going to be both a historical introduction and a thematic introduction to the history of Hindu traditions. And it's impossible to cover everything, of course, in 8 weeks, but we'll try to cover some of the major developments, ideas and traditions of Hinduism. And we're going to be focusing on what might be called the Brahmanical tradition, the Sanskritic tradition. I will explore the textual sources, categories, practices and social institutions of that that form that tradition. And we're going to try and look at primary text in translation from time to time and raise critical questions about caste, about the nature of deity, icons, and we're going to pay particular attention to the Vedanta tradition in this course. So we hope to raise theological and cultural questions about the relevance of the relation between reason and practice. I hope I didn't start too early. Is it 11? It should be about that.
Sorry, it's exactly 11.
I will consider. We'll conclude. The last week will be about Hinduism and modernity. So, yeah, you've got a lecture schedule there, and you've got first Thursday, 11th of October today. You've got a sort of an introduction of what is Hinduism. There's general background reading there. The John Brockington's book, The Sacred Thread, is very good. It's a detailed account of the textual sources and the history of of Hinduism. There's my own chapter 2, an introduction to Hinduism, some of the material I'll be covering today. There's a good introduction by Julius Lippner in his book Hindus. And there's chapters 1 to 2 of Mitalan Thursby's The Hindu World. So any of those books are very good bases for your study. If you don't know anything at all about Hinduism, have a look at Kim Knott's a very short introduction to Hinduism. Or indeed, have a look at Hinduism in the Encyclopedia of Religions, that 15-volume edited by Eliade, those series of volumes. So we may look at the Aryan migration thesis and the controversy of origins today, or I might defer that till next week. I'll see how it goes. So next week we'll be looking at the Veda and the Vedic traditions. The Veda is a sacred scripture, the revelation of Hinduism, and the traditions that flow from it. We'll look at the textual corpus and the traditions that flow from that textual corpus. By text, it was an oral tradition originally. It wasn't written down for a long time, several thousand years probably. Now, there's a few hymns that we might look at next week from the Rig Veda and from the Upanishads. And they're suggested reading there. Now, Halfass's book, Wilhelm Halfass, Tradition and Reflection, he's an excellent writer in my view, and he's a great resource, a very solid kind of work. And he raises interesting questions. He wrote another book called Europe, India and Europe, which is very well worth reading, about the influence of India on the West. Particularly on the romantic philosophers, Schlegel and the Schellings and these kind of characters, the Schlegel brothers. Stephanie Jameson's work, she's a lively writer, I find, and her work is always very interesting. And she's informed by sort of gender issues, and she looks at the Hindu material through a lens of Western concerns about gender, which makes it very interesting reading. Laurie Patton, likewise, has got a good section on the Vedas and Upanishads in Mitalan Thursby's The Hindu World. And I would strongly urge everyone to read Fritz Stahl's Rules Without Meaning, Ritual Mantras and the Human Sciences. It's republished under a book called Rituals and Mantras, and it's an extremely stimulating and engaging book, but very controversial book as well, because, as you can see, Rules Without Meaning, that's what he thinks ritual are, particularly Hindu rituals are are meaningless. Ritual is fundamentally meaningless. So we'll be hopefully next week engaging with some of that material. Also in the tutorials we'll be looking at that. Well, it's quite old, that book now, but it's still very resonant. And Michael Witzel's Vedas and Upanishads again is a good overview of the of these texts and traditions in the Black Book Companion to Hinduism, which some of you will be reading from the tutorials anyway. Then following on week three, we look at Dharma, society and gender, what that word Dharma means. And I'll just bring your attention in the bibliography there to Julia Leslie's book, The Perfect Wife, which is about Stri Dharma, women's Dharma, which often gets neglected. Madan's book, Non-Renunciation, often Hindu traditions get represented in their renunciate capacity, but this is a book about non-renunciation. The dimensions of Hinduism which reject renunciation or are very antagonistic and ambivalent about renunciation. And Patrick Olivelle's The Ashrama System, History and Hermeneutics of the Religious Institution. That's an excellent book about the Hindu social institution of the ashrama system, which will be well explained in due course. There's also Brian Smith's Classifying the Universe, which is a very good exposition of the worldview, of the Vedic worldview of the ancient Indian Varna class system and the origins of caste. Now, Bailey has got a very good history, New Cambridge History of India. It's a very good account of from the 18th century of social institutions in India, particularly caste. And Nick Dirk's The Hollow Crown. You read, that's almost impossible to read all the way through. I don't know, I've never met anyone who's read the whole thing yet. But if you you could read the first... you've read it, you've read the whole thing. Oh, well done. you read the first, you know, the first chapter or two.
Daniel.
Right. And, yeah, so anyway, he also edited a book on power and, I can't remember the precise title now, but it's easily found, on power and colonialism and the construction of caste since colonialism. There is an argument that caste only was is a colonial invention, is perhaps too strong a word, but a construction since the colonial days. Freeman's book, Untouchable, sorry I don't have further bibliographical details on here, but I'll get them for you, is a wonderful account by an anthropologist in the 1950s or 60s about untouchability. And it follows the life of one particular individual or one family in their day-to-day life and their struggle for survival, really, and the relationship with other people in the village. There's... And of course, Homo Hierarchicus by Dumont is the classic study which I would urge you to read, but with a critical eye. Quigley is a short book. You can read that in a very short, in an afternoon or something. The Interpretation of Caste, again, is a response to Dumont and a refutation of Dumont. It's a stimulating read. And a wonderful book is Srinivas, M.R. Srinivas, The Remembered Village. He was an anthropologist who studied in North India, and he got back to Chicago with all his notes and field notes, and there was a fire, and all his notes were destroyed. His whole work was destroyed in a fire. And he then wrote this book, The Remembered Village, which is just from his memory of what his field work was like. And it's probably a blessing in a way that the fire destroyed his notes, because that's a wonderful book, sort of from the heart just comes out. So anyway, I'd urge you strongly to read The Remembered Village by Srinivas, which gives you a good insight into social institutions. There's also a book which by a woman anthropologist, which I haven't got down here, called Love in a Tamil Family by Margaret Trawley. Trawley.
How do you spell this?
T-R-A-W-L-E-Y. T-R-A-W-L-E-Y, which is again a wonderful book, along the kind of in the spirit of Srinivas. So week four, we move on to ascetic traditions. Again, I'd urge you to read Dumont and Histerman and Olivelle. Week five, Indian theism. nothing particularly there that I would like to highlight. David Habermann, acting as a way of salvation, is good on the Vaishnava tradition. And Ron Indens, querying the medieval, raises critical questions about history and historiography in this period. And K.K. Ramanujan, speaking of Shiva, is a wonderful translation of poems to Shiva, dedicated to Shiva, from the Lingayat sect in medieval Karnataka. Okay, the week six, philosophical. We have 2 weeks on philosophical traditions. Again, I look at Halfast there, India and Europe. If you're a hardcore philosopher, try and tackle Guattari's semantic powers, meaning and the means of knowledge. And Chakrabarti's Rationality in Indian Philosophy is a good account, a good overview. Richard King's Indian Philosophy, I think, is a very good introduction to Indian philosophy generally. And I still love Karl Potter's Presuppositions of India's Philosophies. I think that's an excellent book. Ram Prasad wrote a book, Eastern Philosophy, which I haven't read carefully, but I looked through, and that looks like a good introduction as well. Now again, week seven, Indian Philosophy, the reading as above. And here I'd like to draw your attention to Champati's An Indian Rational Theology, an introduction to Udayana's Nyayakusumanjali, which is about philosophy of religion, really. Nyaya, philosophy of religion. And lastly, we end week eight with Hinduism and Modernity, and I'd urge you to look at David Smith's Hinduism and Modernity, and also Ron Indon's Imagining India, in which offers a critique of Western scholarship in India, very much in a sort of deconstructionist mode. And Smith, in his Hinduism and Modernity, responds critically to Indon in one of his chapters. There's also Gauri Vishwanathan's Colonialism and the Construction of Hinduism, which is a very stimulating read because she draws on literature in that, like Ian Forster, to bring that idea to life. So lastly on this handout, you've got a general bibliography. There's, well, any of these really. Bayardo's Hinduism, the Anthropology of a Civilization is a very engaging read. Be wary, as she has a unified vision of Hinduism, which some scholars have been critical of. John Brockington is a very good reference source. Frank Clooney, Hindu Wisdom for All God's Children, in spite of the title, is actually a very engaging and good read. Don't let the title put you off. And Chris Fuller's The Camphor Flame is an anthropological account of Hinduism, which I think everyone should look at some point. Dominic Goodall's Hindu Scriptures is a remake of Zaina's Hindu Scriptures. He's added new material and retranslated some passages. So that's a good text, as it were. And the book edited by Fred Hardy a long time ago now, called The World's Religions, contains some good essays, particularly one by Alexis Sanderson, on the tantric traditions, which we won't really be dealing with in this course. They'll be dealt with in the next course. As translations of the Bhagavad Gita, there's Will Johnson's. It's a very literal translation, and there's a clear translation, I think. Kinsley's Hinduism, A Cultural Perspective, is a thin book, so you can read that in a couple of hours, probably, or an afternoon, which he describes Hinduism in terms of a tension between liberation, which is world renouncing, and world affirmation, which is dharma and your emphasis on social responsibility and social duty. And then Kim Knott's there. Lipner's engaging read as well. Axel Mikhail's Hinduism, Past and Present. I would like to draw your attention to that text, which I think is, again, an excellent book. It's not perhaps a good book to start with, but it's a good book, sort of two or three books into Hinduism, I think. So there we are. And Zaina's book is still worth reading as well. So that's the course overview, and I've drawn you a picture of some bibliographical items. So let us begin. So what's Hinduism then? What is Hinduism? So a simple answer to that question is that it's a term denoting the religions of the people of India who refer to themselves as Hindus, and in Nepal and in some other continents who refer to themselves as Hindus. And in India, there are about 700 million people classified as Hindu, in contrast to Muslim, Christian, Jain, Buddhist, Jew, Parsi, and the Adivasis, or the tribal peoples. Now, all these peoples are within a vast continent that contains 18 official languages and many dialects. And because of the diversity of the peoples and the languages and the practices and beliefs denoted by the term, some people claim that Hinduism, the term Hinduism, is meaningless, is a meaningless abstraction, while others claim that there is a unified field of belief and practice that forms Hinduism, linked to India as a nation and linked to India in its struggle for independence. So there's a politicization of the term Hinduism in recent years. But we are entering a different kind of thought world to the West when we study Hinduism. And it's important to sort of bear that in mind, I think. So in understanding Hinduism, we need to bear in mind, be aware of the development of the category Hinduism has developed in a colonial context, really. And we need to raise questions about category formation and internal and external accounts of identity formation and power. So there's a great problem then in defining Hinduism, because of the wide range of ideas, traditions and practices incorporated by the term. So most Hindus revere a group of texts or body of texts called the Veda, which is regarded as revelation, which we'll be looking at next week, although some do not. And some regard certain rituals as essential for salvation or liberation, while others do not. Some Hindu traditions claim that there's a theistic reality who creates, maintains, and eventually destroys the universe, while other Hindu traditions reject that claim. Some indeed are atheistic traditions. And some claim that there's belief in reincarnation and karma are essential to Hinduism, but other South Asian traditions share those views as well. Jainism does, and Buddhism, in a modified form, has a view of karma and reincarnation, rebirth for Buddhists. Now, part of the problem is that Hinduism has no single founder as well, like Islam or Christianity. There's no unified system of practice and belief that applies throughout the whole tradition. And there's no single system of salvation. There's no centralized authority or bureaucratic structure like the Catholic Church, although there are attempts recently to create those kinds of more systematic structures. So there's a problem of defining Hinduism, what are the boundaries of Hinduism. There's also a problem with the category of religion itself. When Hinduism is described as a religion, we teach world religions, and Hinduism is a world religion. Now, how does that relate to the category of religion itself? Now, in the West, the category of religion is characterized by belief, but arguably not so in Hinduism. A colleague of mine at Stirling, Tim Fitzgerald, has written on this in his book The Ideology of Religious Studies. There's a chapter on Hinduism and the problem of the category Hinduism, and he argues that religion doesn't fit the category Hinduism, doesn't fit the Western notion of religion, because the Western notion of religion is developed in a context of the rise of secularism as well, and that Hinduism just doesn't fit it. So there's the depoliticization of Hinduism has happened in the West. So when John Locke in the 17th century says, after 30 years of religious wars, says, okay, let's stop this. Let's reserve the public realm to the realm of governance in the public realm, and we'll put religion into the private realm, and in an attempt to kind of move away from the terribly bloody religious conflicts that had happened for the previous 30 or 100 years before. So there's this division between the public and the private, and religion in the West gets put into the private realm. And it gets related to the category secularism. What's religious gets opposed to what is secular. Now, So religion, the category of religion, has a history of development in the West. And so it's sort of an indigenous Western Christian category. Now, what's the justification for fitting other traditions throughout the world into that category? And that's what the kind of questions that Fitzgerald raises. So it is difficult, but nevertheless, I mean, religion, the word religion is here to stay, it's with us to stay. And there are kinds of practices and categories within Hinduism that are analogous to the Western category religion. But if religion is in the West is defined by belief, then arguably that is not the case in Hinduism. So Fritz Stahl writes in his book, "A Hindu may be a theist, pantheist, atheist, communist, and believe whatever he likes, but what makes him into a Hindu are the ritual practices he performs and the rules to which he adheres, in short, what he does." So Stahl defines Hinduism in terms of an orthopraxy rather than orthodoxy, which I think has a lot of merits to it. I think also, actually, even Christianity you can look at in those terms as well. So although, say, Orthodox Christianity is called orthodoxy, it's nevertheless very much defined by practice, in my view, and the kinds of practices that people do, like the veneration of icons or whatever, or certain kind of form of the liturgy. Okay, so others then have claimed that Hinduism itself emerged in the 19th century. Certainly the word Hinduism didn't exist before the 19th century, so some argue that Hinduism is actually an invention of the 19th century, as Fitzgerald does, as a consequence of Indian response to colonialism. Indon argues along these lines, and also Richard King, in a very stimulating book, Orientalism and Religion. But it is, as a more recent book by Pennington says, a severe historical misrepresentation to suggest that Hinduism is an invention of the British. Colonialism was never a regime of absolute power in India, but colonialism did create the conditions under which Hinduism, in terms of a world religion comparable to Islam or Christianity, emerged. So you have colonialism created the conditions under which Hinduism could emerge as a religion like Islam or Christianity or Buddhism. But it's not... it was never a sort of a direct causal relationship between the emergence of Hinduism and colonialism, Pennington argues, in his book Who Invented Hinduism, that came out last year. So it's not good enough to claim that colonialism, there's a direct causal link between colonialism and Hinduism, because it grants too much power to colonialism and erases Hindu agency, and we mustn't underestimate the importance of Hindu agency in the construction of their tradition. And many hundreds of millions of people today identify themselves as Hindu and connect with the literary and ritual traditions that they associate with Hinduism. Pennington says, quote, "The claim that Hinduism is merely a modern invention is tantamount to a theological statement about the normative constitution of religious identity, hardly the appropriate or customary turf of the historian." Unquote. A very good point. So Hinduism, then, we might regard, perhaps best regarded, as a continuous result of a continuous historical process over a long, long period of time that includes interventions by colonialists and missionaries, but cannot be reduced to them. So while it might not be possible to arrive at watertight definitions of Hinduism, there are some kinds of practices, texts, and beliefs that are central to the concept of being a Hindu. And there are some others which are on the edges of Hinduism. The term Hindu itself actually was only used, I think, in the 15th century, the term Hindu occurs in relation to mark out a certain range of cultural practices from the Yavanas, from the Muslims, in Kashmir and in Bengal. So and it could have included Buddhists and Jains as well in that term. So like certain kinds of cuisine, cremation of the dead, certain kinds of social practices were seen to be denoted by the term Hindu in its earliest use, which is only in the 15th, 16th century. And the ism gets added in 1820, probably by Ram Mohan Roy. But nevertheless, there are then prototypical forms of Hindu belief and practice that you can identify. So the beliefs and practices of a high caste Brahmin, devotee to the god Vishnu in Tamil Nadu, might be prototypical of Hinduism, whereas the Radhaswami tradition up in the north there, which is close to Sikhism, is not prototypically Hindu, but nevertheless still within the bounds of Hinduism. So prototype theory was developed by a character, American linguist and psychologist called George Lakoff, who wrote a wonderful book called Women, Fire and Dangerous Things, which is about category formation. And he says that the categories do not have rigid boundaries. He developed this idea of prototype theory, that categories don't have rigid boundaries, that some categories have fuzzy edges, and there are degrees of category membership. So sort of Aristotelian categories, it's either X or it's not X, but in the Lakovian theory, it's categories don't have such clearly demarcated boundaries. And the degree of category membership, and these degrees of category membership are related by family resemblance, if you're familiar with that term from Wittgenstein. So the idea that members of a category may be related to one another without all members sharing the same category. So members of a family might not share any common features, but he's got his grandfather's nose and she's got her mother's eyes. And so they don't share any one feature in common, but they're nevertheless related by a kind of collection of properties in a family resemblance. So members of a category may be related to one another without all members having the same properties in common that define the category. So Hinduism as a category in that sense is very much like that. And it's a category with fuzzy edges. But then what's the basis of judgment? If you think that Hinduism is a category with fuzzy edges, you've got to have some criteria of judgment about what is within the category. You've got to develop some basis of judgments about degree of prototypicality. What's the basis of my judgment that a Tamil Nadu Brahmin offering incense or flowers to Vishnu is more prototypical of Hinduism than a Radhaswami devotee meditating on the Guru's form? What's the basis of that judgment? Well, Hindu self-understanding, arguably, is the basis of such a judgment, and scholars' understandings of the common features or principles seen from outside the tradition. So we could say then that there are general features of Hinduism. Many Hindus believe in a transcendent God beyond the universe, but who is yet within all beings. Some Hindus maintain that this being can be worshipped in a number of different forms, as a handsome youth, as a majestic king, as a beautiful girl, as an old woman, or even as a featureless stone. Hinduism sometimes characterized as polytheistic, but that's a problematic category. Yet many Hindus regard different gods as aspects or manifestations of a sacred power, of a single sacred power, a single god. Again, this is a difficult issue. Polytheism has been projected onto Hinduism. Certainly there are many deities, but is Hinduism polytheistic? Or is Hinduism monotheistic? There was I've done some work with a South Indian tradition called the Teyams in Kerala, the Kerala tradition. Teyam is these dance possession rituals in Kerala, where a low-caste dancer gets dressed up in a very elaborate costume and gets possessed by the goddess of the shrine once a year, and they process around the compound, giving darshan, or their vision, to the community. And in different shrines in Kerala, you get the same Bhagavatis, you get the same goddesses. And we asked, me and Rich Freeman, an anthropologist friend of mine, asked this old lady whether the Bhagavati here was the same, that the goddess being performed in this ritual was the same as the goddess being performed in the ritual 2 miles up the road. And she was rather puzzled by this. She said, well, no, this one's here and that one's over there. But you ask a more sophisticated character, and he says, ah, yes, they're all manifestations of the great goddess, you know, so you get quite a range of responses from the Brahmin who's explaining it in theological kind of version, that these are all aspects or manifestations of one being, to this village woman's understanding that they're quite distinct. So you get a range of views. So it's very difficult to generalize on that level. So anyway, okay. Sometimes Hinduism characterizes a polytheistic then, but many Hindus regard these gods as manifestations of a single reality or power. And another feature of Hinduism is perhaps the Veda, which we'll be looking at next week. The Veda, the source of revelation, which is the word means knowledge. And it was believed to be received by ancient sages and communicated to the humanity through these sages, who are, if you like, a bit like radio receivers, if you like, who receive this wisdom or this knowledge and pass it to human community. Other Hindu traditions argue that the Veda is generated by God, is supported by God, is the voice of God in some sense. But the Mimamsa, for example, rejects that view, that there is no God to create the Veda. The Veda is eternal and is without authorship. Another key feature is the word Dharma. Dharma is revealed by the Veda. A Dharma is sometimes used as a translation for the word religion. I was at a Swami Narayan temple last night, and there was the Swami... The Guru was giving a discourse on Hindu Dharma, which was being translated into English as religion, Hindu religion. So perhaps it's the nearest semantic equivalent to the English word religion. So Dharma is the power which upholds the universe. We'll be looking much more at this next week. Supports society and the cosmos. And the 19th century reformers spoke of the eternal religion, the eternal Dharma. Sanatana Dharma, and it specifically refers to the duty of high caste Hindus with regard to their stage of life, their ashrama, and their caste or class. We'll be looking at more of this in the future. So Dharma then is many ways the affirmation of worldly life and social values, but it could also be the rejection of this world in order to attain liberation, some higher goal. Another feature of Hinduism then is the Veda as revelation, Dharma as duty and law and religion. Thirdly, puja, ritual, making an offering to a deity and receiving a blessing. That's a fundamental structure to Hindu traditions. Whether it's as in the Bhagavad Gita, whether it's a flower or a coin or anything, you make an offering to the deity and receive a blessing. And this can be very elaborate, very highly constructed, or it can be very simple. And religion in worldly life is also concerned with practical needs. And so you have Richard Gombrich in his book on Theravada Buddhism argues that you get communal religion, or social religion, and salvational religion. And that's quite an interesting distinction that also applies to Hinduism, I think, to some extent. But salvational religion is often outside of the social religion, which is about the social glue that binds a community together. Now, Hinduism itself, what are the categories that Hinduism uses? Hinduism came up with four purposes of life. What's the purpose of life for a Hindu? And you could say that there are four purposes of life, four goals. Okay, having railed against essentialism and saying that you actually can't make general claims on Hinduism, if you're very fresh to Hinduism, this is a good structure to get hold of. Okay, the Veda as the source of Hindu traditions, and that life has four goals, the Purusharthas. The first goal is Dharma. And there Dharma means duty or responsibility. I'll come to that in a minute. The second goal is wealth or success. Success, Arta. And the third goal is pleasure, karma, particularly sexual pleasure, but it extends beyond that to aesthetic pleasure, going to the theatre, that kind of thing. And the fourth goal is liberation, moksha. And all of these goals had bodies of literature, Sanskrit literature, associated with it. So sutras and shastras, the Bhava sutras and Dharma shastras, Artha Shastra, and Karma, everyone's heard of the Karma Sutra, Karma Shastra. And you get similar, a great body of literature associated with liberation as well. So this is a good kind of structure to get to remember, as it were. So Dharma is regarded as, particularly with regard to two things. One is your Dharma with regard to your class, or varna. And the other is regarding your Dharma, your duty, your responsibility with regard to your stage of life. Life stage. Stage of life's way. Ashrama. Now the class system, which we'll be looking at in more detail in week three, is roughly divided into four. It is divided into four categories. The priestly class, the Brahmins, the priests, the warriors, nobles, the commoners, or the merchants, and the serfs, shudras. Difficult to translate, shudra. So that was a traditional kind of structure, social structure, hierarchical social structure, which is interpreted in a number of different ways in contemporary Hinduism and also in the past. And we'll be looking at those ways that you can understand this. And some have seen this as the basis of the caste system, and others have not. People like Indra and Dirks think that the caste system is of more recent origin. And then you get the stages of life, the student stage, as a high caste householder. These top three classes are regarded as twice born, because you're born once from a womb, and you're born secondly through an initiation ceremony in which you get a sacred thread. The males of the tradition do. The women's second birth is regarded, their marriage is regarded as a second birth. So the Shudras are technically outside of that class system, but the nevertheless part of the matrix of Hindu social life. And arguably this is the basis of contemporary caste system. We'll be looking at this in much more detail later. So if you're trying to form one of these top three classes, you can technically undergo this structure of stages in life, the student stage, the householder stage, in which you get married and fulfill your dharma, and as a householder you can fulfill the goals of wealth and pleasure, as well as social duty. And then technically there was the hermit stage, or the forest dweller stage, in which you retire to the forest with your wife to perform religious duties. And lastly there's the renouncer stage, renunciation, in which you give up the world to seek salvation, to seek the fourth goal of life, liberation from the world. Now the student stage is a celibate stage, in contrast to life in the students in the West. And then you become, you get married and become a householder. And then the hermit stage again is a celibate stage, it's hermit stage of renunciation. And you can become a renouncer from the student stage, missing out the householder stage, and some do. So you take up an orange robe or whatever, staff and a bowl to seek liberation. You wander off to seek liberation. And you see lots of sadhus. It's a very interesting institution, the whole institution of renunciation, which we'll look at in a few weeks' time. So that's a kind of a shorthand. It's a good way of kind of getting hold of some key concepts of Hinduism. The Veda and these, the four goals of life, if you're kind of at sea with some of this. Lastly then, there are, given that structure, there are certain traditions going through time, Brahmanical traditions, and certain key ideas also we might add, like the transmission of tradition through a guru-disciple lineage is terribly important in Hinduism. so you have a guru, and he has a group of disciples, and when he's getting old or passes away, he hands the guruship on to somebody else, and so there's a light, if you like, or a flow through the generations. Sanskrit as a sacred language is terribly important, although Tamil is also a sacred language in the south, and that's terribly important as well, but certainly many key texts are written in Sanskrit, which is regarded as a sacred language, an uncreated language, because the Veda is according to many Hindus is uncreated and has always existed, so therefore likewise Sanskrit, the perfected, well constructed language. And there's a focus of these Brahmanical traditions on a deity or a group of deities. Particularly important are three deities: Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess. Those are arguably the three major kind of historical trajectories through the tradition. And some have argued they're distinct religions. In a book called Hinduism Reconsidered, by Sontheimer and Kulka argue that these are distinct traditions. And argue the smarter tradition is also a distinct tradition, which worshipped five deities. But you also get smarters in these other religions as well. These are the Vishnu, worship of Vishnu, Shiva, and Devi as well.
What did you say
there
in the book?
Hinduism Revisited, that's it. It should be on the bibliography there. Hinduism Reconsidered. Sontheimer and Kulka. So that's a stimulating read. And then you get some theology or some philosophy cuts across these different traditions, like Vedanta cuts across the Shaiva Vaishnava tradition. So you get, it's mainly a Vaishnava tradition, but you do get some Shaivas who adopt Vedanta as well. And you get renouncer traditions, which arguably have a distinct value system from the householder traditions, as Madan argues. And so some have argued you get a tension in Hinduism between moksha, which is what renouncers are after, and it's world negating, some argue, and the values of world affirmation, which are social duty, wealth or success and pleasure, are social values which are world affirming. And some have argued that liberation is a world denying value, because it transcends these worldly goals. And another way of looking at Hinduism is through geography, that there are regional traditions, regional bounded. Fred Hardy was very keen on this, and that you get regional languages rather than Sanskrit, which are most important, and these are bounded by geographical areas. These are popular traditions, often low caste popular traditions, bounded by geographical areas, and you can look at Hinduism through the lens of those traditions rather than the high caste Sanskrit tradition as well. So one of the main features of these traditions is appeasement of hot deities to keep them away from you. So Shitala, the calming, the cool one, she was the goddess of smallpox, and you have to appease her to keep her away from your kids and this kind of thing. Or the Tayam tradition that I referred to earlier in South India, in Kerala. These are deities that demand offerings of alcohol and blood to calm them down and keep them contained. And these are arguably the lifeblood of traditions at village level. So lastly then, you've got on the back of your sheet, you've got a chronology. Here's not an uncontentious chronology. And Hindu self-description tends to place these traditions much earlier. So 2500 to 1500 is a general scholarly kind of understanding of where the Indus Valley civilization, which I'll be talking about next week, and elements of Hinduism may be traced back to that period, as early as that, like bathing in the rivers and so on. In 1500 to 500, you get the Vedic period, you get the rise of Aryan culture. And some push that back much further. Some scholars, particularly in India, this gets highly politicized, this, as some argue that the Indus Valley was the Vedic culture, but anyway, we'll be looking at this controversy next time. We haven't got time today. And then moving forward, we get it gets less contentious. To 500 BC to 500 CE or AD, you get the epic and Puranic periods. Then roughly 500 AD to 1500, what might be called the Bhakti or medieval period. And then 1500 to the present, we can call modern period, in which is dominated by two empires, really, the Mughals and the British. And the 19th century Renaissance Hinduism. And in the 19th century, you get this Renaissance Hinduism emerging. And in the 20th century, the construction or formation of Hinduism as a world religion that we know today. So next week, then, we'll look at the Vedas and Upanishads and raise questions about the origins of Hinduism and the Indus Valley civilization and culture. Are there any questions or points you want to raise?
To what extent would Katanya's theistic be a good definition of Hinduism?
One is god at a time, isn't it? That Zaina coined that term, if I remember. I can't even pronounce it. Katanotheism, yeah. Which is the doctrine that whatever deity you're worshipping is the most important deity. And I think that's certainly a true characterization of the Vedic, of the Vedas, yes. So you praise whatever deity it is, you're the most auspicious, wonderful deity, whatever. And then you go on to another one. That's true of the Tayum tradition. The Tayums, when they worship the person possessed, praises the Tayums in very high, as if they're the greatest deity in the whole universe. And then they praise him in the third person. She is beautiful, wonderful, all powerful, the greatest god in the universe. And then she says it in the second person. You are the most powerful, wonderful. And then he looks into a mirror and says it in the first person. I am the most powerful, wonderful deity in the universe. And the possession is complete. So yeah, I think that's a good. Zaina's term is quite useful.
But surely that doesn't take into account what individual texts say about particular deities. Well, that category is it's a kind of very distant interpretation of it, almost from a anthropological view rather than a theological or a philosophical one.
Yeah.
Because you take it textually.
Yeah.
Individual deities are more defined in their particular properties that they would have for the worshipper.
Yeah.
And some only really figure in the shape of Dharma, some in moksha, some in pleasure.
Yeah.
And some in attaining wealth.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so the deities are in a context that you have to understand the context in which they're worshipped. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So all of these categories are problematic when you look at Hinduism through those categories, pantheism, polytheism. So I think they can be a useful point to start with in order to get into the thing. But once you're in there, it's better to understand it in terms of indigenous categories.
In terms of Ishta Devata, it's also you could say it's something that is you worship your particular deity, but it's also within the kind of larger tradition, or it's not personal, but it's also within kind of if you worship Shiva or if you worship Krishna, and there could be Ishta Devata, there's a particular form of Krishna.
That's right. So it's particularized to your individual needs, is perhaps the wrong word, but
taste,
something like that. Yeah.
Well, a brief comment from Christine Bishop, but there are some interesting models implicit in this introduction for solving the current dilemma going on in the Oxford faculty about the nature of the doctrine of the Trinity.
Oh, really?
This current social emphasis on theology and the Trinity, and Professor Fidace's thing of having a kind of without having any being, you nevertheless have relationality.
Oh, relationality without being.
Being.
And
the is something here that I think would be a useful analogy there.
Right, right.
But that is simply...
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Comment.
Thank you, yeah. So we have to wind up now, so I'll see you next week.